This is Mark Strassman, reporter with GridWorld. We're about to speak with Dr. Eric Jacobson, who heads the biomedical information, no, who heads the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology at the National Institute of General Medical Science. Welcome to GridWorld.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
I've had a certain amount of confusion here with the many acronyms and titles here. Why don't we try to locate your organization that you work for? We could start with the President of the United States and take it down to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which runs National Institutes of Health, which runs National Institute of General Medical Sciences, which is almost where you are.
Right, and then you find me.
Right. And
I really wear two hats.
Okay.
One of my hats, I direct the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology in the Institute of General Medical Sciences.
Right.
And my other hat is as chair of an NIH-wide organization called the Biomedical Information Science and Technology Initiative Consortium.
They only let PhDs get that job because you need to be able to remember all those. That's about an eight-word title, isn't it?
Well, actually, either a PhD or perhaps, I mean, there are certain mental disorders where you
right.
memorize, where you actually have an absolutely photographic memory but can't reason. So
idiot savant.
Right.
Okay.
But but essentially, that second job is to be the point of coordination for lots of different things that are going on around the NIH with respect to biomedical computing, and most specifically with respect to building a biomedical computing infrastructure for the country.
Okay. In fact, it's kind of like being this chief information officer of the biological and computational biology part of the agency, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of like being the chief information officer for the extramural part
right.
of the agency, for the part of the agency that disperses funds to the extramural community.
Okay. Oh, in other words, you want to make sure that all of the different places and the different universities and private institutions and so on that are doing biological research are essentially on the same page and are using the same standards so that they can exchange data in an easy and convenient way.
Well, on the same page with respect to building an infrastructure for everybody to use.
Okay.
So we could sort of parse out the grants that we put out as three different kinds, and one kind would be hypothesis-driven research, where you've got a certain idea about how a biological system works, and you want to test it by some combination of experiment and theory and simulation and data analysis and so forth.
Right.
A second kind of research would be essentially discovery research. You just want to look at a system and see everything that's there.
Right.
And this would be exemplified, for example, by the various genome projects, by sequencing all the genes in an organism.
Right.
And understanding the structure of the genetic material and its organization. And the third kind that we really need to get everybody on the same page on is building infrastructure. And so this is a major preoccupation of the Trans-NIH initiative that I chair, and to some extent the center that I direct, is how do we build a computing environment for all biologists to use, a computing environment that is extremely powerful, where all the tools are interoperable, where any individual can sit down at his desk and have at his keyboard all of the information sources, analysis tools, visualization tools, modeling tools, and interpretive materials that individual needs to do his or her job, whether they're a basic researcher, a teacher, a student, a policymaker, a practitioner, all of the different players in the entire biomedical enterprise.
And because this is GridWorld, also for them to have enough computing capacity to run whatever models or investigations they're doing.
That's right. So they need to be able to reach out and find access to the compute power they need, the information they need, the tools that they need.
Now, this project is called the Biomedical Information Science and Technology Initiative, or BISTI?
BISTI, right.
Okay, and the organizations that participated in it are called BISTIC, the BISTI Consortium.
The Consortium. And essentially, we have representation from almost all of the 27 institutes and centers that make up the NIH.
Now, how long has this project been afoot?
BISTIC was created following a 1999 panel report. This was a panel of external people primarily that recommended the creation of BISTIC and the establishment of the National Centers for Biomedical Computing. And there were a few acting chairs of BISTIC.
Right.
I was hired just a little bit less than a year ago as the first permanent chair, as much as anything in this world is permanent.
Right.
But the first permanent chair.
Now, did you inherit a blueprint, literally or figuratively, for this infrastructure, or has specifying that infrastructure been an important part of what you've been doing over the last year?
Yeah, with the help of an external committee and a lot of people inside, I was on point to actually write the blueprint in the first 9 days of my time here.
All right. Well, okay.
And my first day was May 19th.
Right.
And that was a day that, by prior arrangement, an external committee was coming together with a group of NIH program people to devise or develop to strategize about writing an 8 to 10 year roadmap document that was due in Dr. Zerhouni's office on May 28th, 9 days later.
Dr. Zerhouni being?
The director of the National Institutes of Health.
Right, this is sort of like waiting to do your PhD thesis until the weekend before it's due or something.
Right.
So you were able to do it, though.
Oh, yeah, we had a wonderful day-long meeting and tremendous number of ideas. Judith Greenberg, who was chairing the committee, just orchestrated the discussion really well, and we covered essentially we built a parts list.
Right.
That consisted of all of the things that we wanted to do over the next 8 to 10 years, parsed them out into what we thought we could do in the first 3 years, the middle 3 years, and the last 3 years.
Right.
And whether they were pretty straightforward, so we were pretty sure we could do them, whether they were some moderate difficulty or whether they were really hard, and put all this on a 3x3 grid.
Right.
and then wrap some narrative, and then I came off and took the parts list and wrapped some narrative around it and assembled a couple of specific proposals to really do things, the primary one of which was the creation of the National Centers for Biomedical Computing. And so that and so those are, you know, we were then authorized about 2 months later to actually put out a funding announcement for those, and we did that, and the first round of those applications are under review right now.
How much is the whole thing going to cost over 10 years?
That's a very good question. At full speed, the National Centers for Biomedical Computing will be costing about $4 million a year each, so roughly $30 million for the national centers. And I would say that for very, very roughly, we'll probably spend a total of twice that in collaborating projects, smaller collaborating projects with the centers. So I think we're talking about gearing up for a software engineering enterprise to build this national infrastructure that in a few years will be approaching $100 million a year and maybe relatively steady at that. So we're talking about somewhere between $500 million to $1 billion over a 10-year period, which is not an enormous amount of money for a software engineering enterprise of this size.
And what's it going to deliver once it's in place?
One way that I like to try to make an analogy for it is for people to think about what is on their desktop, where in contrast to 10 years ago, where you had a bunch of different applications that didn't talk to each other,
right.
Now your word processor, your calendar program, your email program, your spreadsheet, your database program, all of these entities really work together, transfer data readily between each other. And this was done, well, there's billions of dollars of engineering that went into that.
Right.
So what we're proposing is to do something like that, except it's going to be done out on the grid, and it'll integrate, for example, modeling tools for biological systems at all stages of organization, from the molecular level to the network level to the cellular level to the tissue level and organismic level. It'll integrate genomic data with data that is gathered from microarray experiments and proteomics experiments and yeast 2 hybrid experiments, and actually will include some data that are simulated data, and it'll include visualization data, and all of these things where they should work together, where, for example, you should be able in an integrated way to look at an MRI scan and query the system about what are the likely molecular events that underlie what you're seeing in an MRI picture, that you ought to be able to move from this more integrative level and looking at, let's say, a whole brain to drilling down into cells and molecules in conceptual space.
Right, in fact, exactly. That's just what I was visualizing here as I was listening to you, that you've got some sort of cell membrane that's doing kind of things, and you ought to be able to mouse over a particular part of it and get the nucleotide chain that's that created it, and then do it with the other part of whatever chemical is coming in to try to do something to it, and see how those might or might not fit together. And that's essentially the level where you're talking about creating.
Exactly right.
Right.
And so, of course, none of this is trivial, either technically or conceptually, but the goal is that people's ability to explore these ideas and to move from one domain of thinking to another domain of thinking, from one kind of data to another kind of data, and their ability to integrate the results from disparate forms of data into some hypothesis or some explanation for what is really going on, that the goal is that should not be limited by the software.
Okay.
It should only be limited by the amount of data that's there and by how clever people are.
Right.
And in particular, that people shouldn't have to go to one kind of computing environment to look at genomic data,
right.
Another kind of computing environment to look at macroscopic data, and then, you know, just in some not exactly manual way, but in a way where you move in and out of one computational space to the other, have to piece things together. These computing environments and data environments ought to work together.
Okay, let's digress to politics for a second, then get back to the technology. Is the funding for this program a slam dunk, or is it problematic?
Oh, it's not a slam dunk. I think we're projected to. It's not a slam dunk, but it's likely.
Okay.
But I think we've got to perform to do
so
it.
So there are early things you have to do to get the later money, presumably.
Right. And what we really have to demonstrate with the early money is that we really are adding value to what everybody's doing. That we really are making things better and easier for folks who are doing cancer research, for folks who are doing neurological research.
Well, will it be enough to show that you're making work easier for those researchers, or will it be essential that you make some kind of significant substantive breakthrough using the system and demonstrate its value that way?
Well, breakthroughs have to be made using computation, but the fact is, breakthroughs are made using computation all the time now. So if we look, for example, at this year's biomedically relevant Nobel Prizes. The Nobel Prizes in chemistry were for work in ion channels.
Right.
One was for the structure of voltage-gated channels. Well, the ability to get those structures out of the raw X-ray data depended critically on some serious computation and actually some algorithms that were the subject of an earlier Nobel Prize to Herbert Hofmann for solving the phase problem in X-ray crystallography. Similarly, the work by Peter Agre in discovering the water channel, where that was really based on genomic analysis that could not have been done without modern computation and databases.
And in fact, as biological research moves into the computing context, there should be a Nobel Prize in biological computation eventually, shouldn't there?
Well, maybe there will or maybe there won't, because often methods don't get Nobel Prizes.
It's findings that get the
prize. It's the findings and the discoveries. But you know, that's really fine. So I don't think there's any doubt that we're going to continue to see breakthroughs where computation is really important. What we have to make the case for is that by improving the efficiency and the power of the computing environment, that we're going to make those things come faster, that we will accelerate the pace,
right,
that we will no longer be a rate-limiting step for the pace of making breakthroughs.
So, in fact, making the infrastructure that makes the work of the researchers easier is exactly what needs to be done in order to further the substance of the biological discovery.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Since this is Grid World, tell us how grid computing figures into everything you're doing there at your two jobs.
Well, essentially, it's got to be grid computing that delivers this to people's desktops. I mean, we're talking about a level of compute power that you're not going to load onto your desktop,
right?
Because there's just going to be too much stuff. Even with a really big hard drive, it's just not going to. And so on. It's just not going to happen. So what we're looking for in parallel, of course, what we're seeing in parallel is that at the same time that NIH is embarking on this software engineering project, the National Science Foundation is building the TerraGrid.
Okay, tell our new listeners what the TerraGrid is.
So the TerraGrid is in its first manifestation, is going to be a connection between very, very powerful machines at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, Argonne National Lab, the San Diego Supercomputing Center, the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center, and Caltech. And among these five sites, there's going to be an enormous amount of compute power, an enormous amount of data storage, capability to do group-to-group communication, and the ability to, and it'll be a test bed for distributing computations and distributing data across a wide array of places, and in such a way that the user looking in, it looks like one machine.
How close to fruition is that TerraGrid project?
Well, it's in pretty early days. They're just building it.
Right.
But it's the blueprint for it is, you know, is that the TerraGrid is going to be the backbone for a national computing grid where ultimately all the compute power will be everywhere relatively seamlessly. I mean, obviously there are going to be bigger pipelines in some places and narrower pipelines to other places, in much the same way, I guess, as there are superhighways in some places and smaller highways at other places. But at some level, everything should be accessible everywhere. And we really need, for our software engineering in the final analysis, to deliver everything that we want it to deliver, and the nation really needs it to deliver, it's really going to depend on the computational grid being built in parallel to deliver that.
Now, who's going to, when I was at Stanford and actually reporting on the Stanford Linear Acceleration Center and so on, the idea of big science, big money, big technology meant that everyone wanted access to the time on the accelerator, and not everyone could have it all the time. People would have to sign up for it, essentially.
Right.
How is that expected to work in terms of this TerraGrid, and who is going to determine how, and how are they going to determine it as to who gets access to do what on this system?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't think we know the pricing policy on this. I think that it'll work best if it's really free and if it's a public good.
Free,
if
free
like
as
the
in free
interstate
as
highway system.
Free as in free speech or free as in free beer?
Free as in you're free to get in your car and drive anywhere.
Right.
And the roads aren't toll roads.
Right. Meaning anyone could... all right. So you're saying that it would... All you got to do is log on and start computing?
Right. That's how, you know, this idea is subject to change, but
right.
It's certainly in my mind, that's the idea that I have.
That's certainly a simple pricing policy.
And obviously somebody pays, but,
right.
But it's a collective price. And this is in fact what we have decided on for our highways. Pretty
right.
much. I mean, the only tiny minority of our roads are toll roads.
Pennsylvania Turnpike, for one.
Yeah. It's what we've decided on. It's how we run libraries.
Right.
Which is another way of disseminating information. And so maybe the libraries and the highways are kind of good analogies for this.
Well, let me follow up, though. Is this anyone off the street, or is this just certified biological researchers who will be able to access it when they need it?
And if so, who
certifies them?
I think anybody off the street. I mean, everybody has concerns.
Okay.
You're a concerned citizen. You would like
right.
to get the latest information on this symptom that you feel, or you want to. You want to think in an informed way about something your doctor told you.
Well, what if you want to animate? What if you want to render a cartoon you've designed on your computer, and you want some cycles to render your cartoon?
So, I think that the way actually that things will be maybe rationed
right.
finally
right.
is that there'll be some level of access that's completely public.
Right.
But that's going, that may be so cluttered with junk that there's going to be a second level of access that's faster, that's more private, that may have some of the specialized tools that are not, you know, available to everybody, that because in point of fact, I mean, yeah, the ideal would be everything's freely available to everybody.
Right.
That may not work. In fact, it probably won't work in its pure form.
Right.
What may work is something like, oh, the national health system in England, where there's a level of medical care that's available to everybody, and then some people pay extra for private care. So we may have a couple of classes of citizens. I think that there's some level of stuff that really, truly ought to be available to everybody. I think that every student and every teacher ought to have access to biological data and analysis tools and modeling tools just by logging onto a networked computer.
In terms of educational programming for people from K-12 to university and so on, this would seem like a pretty good tool for that. You've got the visible man and woman, you know, to the nth degree here. And people on their own or people in classes could be making use of this, it seems, and essentially disseminating the best information from the best teachers and scientists to everybody, and thereby raising the level of scientific and medical and biological knowledge around the whole country.
Well, we are, in fact, hoping to nurture that, and we have we are launching an education effort at NIGMS. We've participated in one roadmap funding announcement for interdisciplinary curricula. We're preparing a second funding announcement right now that's going to be more that's going to be targeted specifically at undergraduate biology education, and I think you'll see us being more active in trying to support people to develop computational approaches to teaching biology. And in fact, we are writing another funding announcement, a third funding announcement, for education projects that would collaborate with our National Centers for Biomedical Computing to utilize the tools and the computing environments that are developed at those centers for education.
Now, in fact, Winston Churchill some time ago said, "We shape our billions, and then our billions shape us." Essentially, what you've got here is us shaping our computing infrastructure, mm-hmm. and then that infrastructure is shaping us in important ways, both educationally and in terms of research.
There really is a dual adaptation. I mean, people talk about computing environments, because when you're deeply into a task at your machine, you really psychologically really do go into the machine.
It's not much different than being in some imaginary role play world, or being in some molecular genomic world where you're essentially relating as colleagues to these virtual images and concepts that are made visible through the computer.
They're made visible, they're made real, and the most important thing is that they become transformed into models of reality in your brain.
Right. And in fact, in the same way that early humans back on the savannah had to calculate a cheetah this and water that and roots this, because they saw it, they were dealing with it visually and then conceptually and then behaviorally. Essentially, we've gotten down so deep into the nature of matter and biology here that the same kind of processes can be put to work to make that same kind of sense out of what's happening at the molecular level as we did 100,000 years ago on the more grossly physical level.
And you know, it may be the first time since we came out of the hunter-gatherer mode that we're really using all our brains.
Or more of them, anyway.
Or a lot more of them.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things that's really, there's you may know perhaps of Jared Diamond and several books that he's written.
Right.
One of them is Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Right.
And in that book, Diamond, who spends part of his life doing field work on birds and really being living with people who are hunter-gatherers, and another part of his life he spends in Los Angeles,
right,
and he marveled at how much more practical intelligence the hunter-gatherers had than the people he knew in Los Angeles.
Right.
And it has something to do with how rich the environment is and how critical it is for them to understand all the richness of the environment, because it's life and death to know,
right,
which plants are okay to eat, which are poisonous, where the habits of animals and so forth. And our environments in civilization have been very, very simplified. But now I think in rich computational environments, we now are starting to get back in a more modern technological context to environments that are really conceptually very, very rich and really do provide us the opportunity to, I think, use more of our brains than media do that have fewer dimensions.
So we could be entering a new renaissance of people actually thinking more clearly about more complicated and interesting things and coming up with a whole range of new discoveries.
Well, I believe that we're already seeing this in the sense of people becoming expert in more than one scientific discipline.
You are noticing that? That is happening?
I'm noticing it among the students that I have in my laboratory in Illinois. And we're seeing students now coming into our graduate programs, for example, in biophysics, who have really deep knowledge of both biology and physics and chemistry.
Right.
And I think that a fair amount of this is that it's now possible, if you know how to look and search, to absorb more information. It's possible to get information faster. It's possible to feed information to yourself much more rapidly if, for example, you have journal articles available to you on computer and much quicker ways to index them and access them,
right,
than going to the library. So you simply can flood yourself with more information and more precisely targeted information for a particular thing you want to learn than it was ever possible to do
so
before.
So the overhead of having to wander around the stacks or the card catalogs is gone, and you can essentially put your energy into just assimilating the information and learning the concepts and so on.
Yeah, and I think that, and so it's possible, for example, now, in just a few really focused days, to get up to speed on the literature of some area of biology that, you know, you've never looked at before.
Even especially if it's a field that's constantly changing and the findings are being constantly revised, if you just tune into what's been done in the last quarter, you're not going to be much worse off than someone who's been studying it for 10 years and has had to remember and forget the 97% of the material.
Well, and especially because the articles that you read will have references.
Right.
So you can peel back to those. Or another way to do things is to take the seminal reference in a particular field, and now the journals that are online, some of them will tell you all the articles that have cited that paper.
Right. So you can go out, so you can start with Gray's Anatomy and then...
Yeah. So, for example, I mean, I referred to, you know, the Nobel Prize work that had been done a few years ago in voltage-gated channels, which was awarded the prize this year.
Right.
So there's a seminal paper that's sort of a mandatory citation for anybody who's doing structure function relationships in the ion channels, which is the 1998 paper from Rod McKinnon's lab that first showed the structure of the voltage-gated potassium channel. So you can go to the Science Magazine website, and you can get a list of all of the papers since then that have cited that paper. And it's essentially a literature, it's essentially a one-stop literature survey of what you really need to read about structure and structure-function relationship in voltage-gated channels.
Well, from everything you've been saying, I think we should start expecting more results here than we have in the past.
You're putting me on the spot. I hope you're right.
I'm just trying to urge you on to greater heights. How important is it that non-scientists be aware of what you're doing and what your colleagues are doing? It's been an issue for some time, and from what we've been talking about today, it's obviously going to get more of whatever it's been so far in terms, or is it, in the distance between the specialists and the generalists and both of them and the general public, or will this technology be able to bridge that gap and make it possible for vaster arrays of everyday people to be privy to the kind of information that only scientists had before? What about that issue of
both of those things are possible?
Right.
And my belief and my hope and what I try to work towards when a chance to do it comes my way is a greater democratization of scientific knowledge, and really using these technologies to make it possible for everybody to understand biology at as deep a level as they want to invest the time and the attention in understanding, but they shouldn't be blocked by obscure jargon. They shouldn't be blocked by lack of appropriate interpretive materials. They shouldn't be blocked by anything in the information environment, and it all should be there for them.
Because,
so,
as that now is, most people, I think, get most of their medical information from 2-minute segments on the local news that say cholesterol is good, cholesterol is bad, drinking wine is good, drinking wine is bad, exercise more, don't smoke, and so on.
Right.
Rather than reading, articles about voltage-mediated channels in the cells, is there anything that this could do for that? I was thinking that, in addition to making the information accessible, you were talking it needs to be jargon-free. Maybe you could build a program that converts the language of journals into a more readily accessible language, even a visual language, that would clearly and accurately and explicitly say, here's a little cholesterol molecule, blah, blah, blah. And then people can Google into cholesterol and get that place.
Right.
And then be able, and eventually be able to plug their genome into the process.
Right.
And it'll say, here's how, this is not just your brain on drugs for anybody, this is your coronary arteries on cholesterol, and let people see it. Is that part of the plan to
right.
do public
so,
education that way?
So one of the things that I think we ought to really start pushing in public education is giving people the ability to really find the health information and biology-related information on the internet
right.
in ways that they can. There's a very great problem now in the sense that if you put a keyword into Google for almost anything related to biology or health, there's a whole lot of garbage.
Right.
And so people really need a sort of starter kit of techniques to find the better material. And I think that really should be part of every high school biology course, for example. It really ought to begin before high school, where in high school science classes, kids are shown how to find and look up and identify reliable and relevant information with respect to science questions. And it actually is there. to some extent, and it could be better, and we are, I think, through our, you know, the education programs, be looking to stimulate the creation of better material in biology on the web. But also, people really need some initial guidance in how to find the good material.
Right. Well, maybe that's something for further discussion, I think, that I'd like to look into more. Very briefly, either make one up or use one that you know about. Take a biological problem and essentially explain how it's parsed and put on the grid and what comes out, what goes in, who puts it in, how is it processed, and how does it come out, and then who gets it. To just sort of give us an idea about how the biological computation and the grid work together.
Well, so here's an example of specifically grid computing in the sense that it's often used of putting things out on lots and lots of processors,
right,
on the machine. And there were a couple of projects that were directed by Graham Richards, who's at Cambridge University in England. One was for finding lead compounds for anti-cancer drugs.
Right. What's a lead compound?
And so a lead compound is something that you have identified that looks promising because it has an interaction with an important biological receptor.
Right.
And so you think it's worth taking. You could identify things as a lead compound. Traditionally, or early on, this was done by looking at biochemical reactions in essentially the test tube or your reaction vessel or whatever. But now it's possible to take a first crack at lead compounds computationally, to do docking experiments where you take a molecule and you jiggle it around in the computer in the vicinity of a receptor that has a lot of biological significance, and see how well it fits and what's likely to be the affinity. So there's a in one of the projects that Graham directed, there were they took the structures of several receptors that are known to be important surface receptors in cancer cells.
Right.
And they did docking experiments, computer docking experiments, on many, 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 many different small molecules.
Right. I don't want to suggest something that's probably been suggested and or rejected long ago. Can't they reverse engineer the profile of the receptors and figure out what ought to fit into them and then try to match that to some real compounds?
What was being done, but it turns out to be very compute intensive. You can only do it by trial and error. The thing that's working against you in terms of being able to do this in a closed form,
right,
is this combinatorial explosion of shapes that molecules can take, especially organic molecules.
Right.
Because you can, depending on which corner of a carbon molecule you tuck a group, you just take the shape of this thing off in a totally different direction. And so you string a few carbon molecules together, and suddenly you have, even for relatively small molecules, an enormous proliferation of possible shapes.
Instead of looking for a molecule that matches the profile that you need, can't they be built? Specifications? Or am I wandering beyond the ability of science here?
Not really.
See what
I'm saying? It turns out that there isn't really a more efficient way to do it,
right,
than to do it by trial and error,
okay,
on the computer.
All right.
And just to take all the shapes and have the computer just turn them around and and see how they fit.
So essentially what a 2 or 3 year old does with a board that has a star and a triangle and a circle and has the blocks and tries to fit them together, it's essentially that same process, although multiplied many millions of times.
So what Graham did is he engaged a group of technology people to set up a system where he was able to get some 30,000 people to volunteer their computers, the spare cycles on their computers, and let this run in the background and just test many, many, many compounds against the shapes of the receptors and came out with several dozen lead compounds that are now being explored in wet lab and animal experiments.
So it's a little like searching 10 million pieces of hay in a haystack to see if they show any needle marks on them, so that you can find the needle.
But with the computer, you can do it comprehensively.
Right. Every one. Right.
Every one.
Okay. So, and how long ago was that? Is that something of a model now for Greek computing in biology, and are other people repeating the process?
So there are a lot of pharmaceutical companies that are now doing similar kinds of computations within their companies in order to streamline the search for lead compounds, because hopefully that'll cut some of this time. That's it's not only time, but it's very expensive to bring drug molecules through the pipelines.
Now, are these companies going to use tools that your organization is creating at taxpayer expense to make powerful and valuable compounds that they're going to sell and make billions of dollars? Huh?
No. They're doing this at their expense.
Oh, okay.
On the other hand, they use bodies of knowledge that have been developed at public expense. For example, there's lots of structural biology that on biological molecules that's been developed at taxpayer expense that drug companies use. But in terms of specific searches for specific lead compounds, that's all done at their own expense.
But will they be using some of the tools that you're developing for in your own?
Yeah, they are using tools that have been publicly developed, and we're working on enhancements to that class of tools.
Okay. Where does the U.S. Rank worldwide in its development of these computational tools?
I think we are still, I think we're the major drivers of development of computational biology tools, although...
They're doing something in Europe?
Oh, yeah, they're doing a lot in Europe. And the reason I'm pausing is because I really hadn't previously considered the question.
Ah.
So it's not something that I have a ready answer for. And during my pause, I was just thinking about a variety of tools, computational tools and programs that I know of, and thinking of where they're developed. I think the United States is the big driver, but certainly there's a lot of really significant work that's come from Europe as well.
Would it make sense to be in touch with them and coordinate whatever kind of infrastructure they're building with your infrastructure, so you don't end up with two really good but incompatible infrastructures?
That's really an excellent question. So we are, I've just been reading a report on the state of things in Europe in bioinformatics, and we're co-funding with the National Science Foundation a team of people who are actually going to travel to both Europe and to Asia, and to not only talk to researchers, but to talk to program people there and to share, to find out from them and to share with them where we are and where they are, not only in terms of what we've accomplished and what's out in the literature, but of what program plans are.
Because the Indians and the Chinese are both working on grids for themselves,
yes.
And presumably there are plenty of good scientists in both of those places, and from what you've been saying, of course, about trying to create this the system that's going to be not only a hardware grid and a software grid, but a human grid of all of the researchers and so on, it's obvious, the obvious imperative is to globalize it and to involve everyone everywhere in it, if for no other reason than because you could use the computing power when some people are asleep and other people aren't, but at a more profound level because you want everybody involved in this project.
I agree with that completely. And I think this is going to be a, one of the wonderful things about science anyway is that science is global and international, and certainly this part of science actually really has the potential to be even more so than other areas because it's so relatively easy to move information around the globe as compared to
people,
equipment to do wet lab work and so forth.
And in terms of specific things, for example, people in Hong Kong who get a new kind of flu, and then get on the plane and fly to Toronto and so on, you're going to want the people in Hong Kong to have access to everything they possibly can as soon as possible, so that they can, because it's really it's all really one global village in that sense, and you want the resources to be able to be brought to bear wherever they're needed.
That's absolutely right. We are in my first 10 months here, that hasn't been really high on my agenda because I've had so much stuff to just do and get in place locally, but as we move forward, that's definitely really, really important.
Okay, one or two last things. What are your biggest frustrations, if there are any, in your job, and what are your biggest satisfactions?
Well, my biggest frustration is that there's just not enough time to do everything, so that nothing moves quite as fast. There are always loose ends. Nothing moes quite as fast as I want. But, I was saying to a friend who is at the Human Genome Institute, gee, I wish I could clone myself.
And he said, when can you come over?
And she said...
She said.
And she said, oh, so you'd like a baby to take care of? So I said, oh, yes, that's right. I wouldn't be a fully formed adult.
No,
right?
You wouldn't.
So I put that idea aside, but the biggest satisfaction is actually seeing us move forward. I mean, we now really have a plan in place, and we're implementing the first steps in explicitly building computing infrastructure for the nation. Which, up to now, biomedical computing infrastructure and tools had been a more or less incidental byproduct of research that was done for other purposes. So we've really gotten, I think, in this first year, buy-in to the idea that creating infrastructure is really essential and is really worthwhile in this area of science.
Have there been people in NIH or even in the U.S. Senate who've spearheaded this? Do you have some big public champions or not? Or has it just been the scientists submitting their budgets and getting them approved?
This has really come from the grassroots. I think in general that Congress has been concerned about being robust computationally,
right.
Just in general, that this is this is seen as important for us to have in many areas.
For economically, national security, and others.
Right. That we really be at the leading edge in terms of computing technology, and biology is one of those areas. So there's a sort of general appreciation of the importance of this, but not any really specific champions of this over, you know, as compared to other areas of science. Really, the focus on this has come from, I'd say it's almost an emerging awareness, rather than a single person or a small group of people, but an emerging awareness that we could move biomedical research, that computing is really important to biomedical research, and that we could move biomedical research along faster if our computing infrastructure for this purpose was better.
Right. Well, I think you've done a great job in explaining some of the dynamics of that process, and I want to thank you for appearing on Grid World, and to let you know I hope you have continued success with all these projects, and perhaps we'll talk again about them as the progress continues.
Okay, my pleasure. Glad to talk with you.
Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye.